Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We've all done it. We've asked for proof, claimed we had a theory, or said that we'd like to eat more natural or organic food. Were we using these terms correctly? Probably not. It seems that when these words, once considered scientific, made it into our daily conversation, their true definitions got lost. Annalee Newitz is editor-in-chief at IO9, Gawker Media's science and culture blog. She's also written for Popular Science, Wired, and New Scientist, among others. Her article, 10 Scientific Ideas Scientists Wish You Would Stop Misusing, compiles the opinions of a group of scientists about their worst pet peeves when it comes to misusing scientific terminology. It was featured on IO9. Annalee, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So first on the list, proof. What's the real definition and how does it differ from how people typically use it?
Well, one thing I want to say is that it's not that people are misusing these terms in everyday life. It's just that for scientists, a word like proof has a very different meaning from what we use in our everyday lives. And it's almost actually the opposite meaning. So when we say to each other, you know, do you have proof that this glass is full of ice? What we mean is there an absolute truth to that fact? You know, can you show me the glass of ice and, you know, measure it with some kind of measuring device and say, yes, it's full? But for a scientist, the thing is that you can never have something be absolutely true, because for a scientist, truth is something that you are constantly testing, and it's always based on gathering evidence. And that's something that's hard for us, because we want things to just be true or false.
Hmm. Another sort of sticky or gray area there is the idea of a theory. So what, Annalee, is the difference between a scientific theory and, say, having a theory about, you know, how the dog keeps getting out of the yard?
Right. So I think when we say theory in everyday life, we often mean, you know, I have rank speculation, or I just sort of pondered something and I'm not really sure if it's true. But for a scientist, a theory is about as close as you can get to something being true. You know, things like gravity are theories, even though, you know, 100% of the time when you drop an apple on someone's head, it will crash onto their head and probably make a bonking noise. It's still a theory because, well, for a scientist, you know, maybe there's some aberrant case in which dropping the apple wouldn't result in gravity pulling it down onto someone's head, in which case we want to be able to revise that theory. We don't want to say it's absolutely true, because that leaves us in a position of not being able to do science, because science is about questioning everything. But like I said, when you hear a scientist say that something is a theory, that basically means they think it's true. You know, they probably wouldn't admit it if you push them up against the wall. They'd say, well, but it could always maybe be proven false with other kinds of data. Although they probably wouldn't use the word proven. But but really, a theory is the word within science for truth, and which is really the opposite of how we use it in daily life.
Well, I guess that's the problem. There aren't a lot of absolutes in the way that scientists approach things. So what happens when we have words like natural and organic? These things get bandied about all the time, especially when it comes to food. But you can say that something is natural and be dangerous, like snake venom. So talk to me a little bit about the problem with how these two terms often get misused.
Yeah, and that these were words that came up a lot when I talked to scientists, organic especially, because organic has a meaning in science, which is basically anything that contains carbon. So you could be munching on a pencil and having an organic breakfast. please don't do that. but you could be. But it also has a meaning outside of science. It has a meaning in marketing. Foods are marketed as organic, and that actually has a meaning. And various regulatory agencies have a meaning that they've assigned to organic for people who are growing food and raising animals. So those definitions, oftentimes when people use the marketing definition of organic, they mistake it for the scientific definition. They believe that there's some kind of scientific verification that whatever they're eating is healthy, which is absolutely not true. There is no scientific notion of healthier food that is natural or organic. And if you talk to scientists who study biology, what they'll tell you is that, in fact, sometimes when things are natural, which is to say naturally occurring, they are very dangerous. Snake venom is a great example. Many kinds of poisons are absolutely natural. Don't eat deadly spiders is a really good piece of advice, even though they're absolutely natural and might fit the definition of organically farmed. But at the same time, lots of things that are unnatural, lots of medicines that we've invented, for example, insulin, those are things that are synthetic and they're, of course, quite beneficial. And so the idea that you can divide the world into things that are bad and synthetic and good and natural or good and organic is profoundly unscientific. Like I said, it's perfectly legitimate as a marketing term, but please don't get it confused with science. And I think many scientists would rest easier if they knew that we were refusing to confuse those ideas.
Annalee Newitz is straightening us out. She's talked to a number of scientists about some of their pet peeves or some of the terminology that gets thrown around in our daily language that has supposedly scientific meaning but is probably not being used in quite the right way. Well, let's get to one other one, learned versus innate. Why does evolutionary biologist Marlene Zuk, I'm assuming that's how you say her name, have to say about her pet misuse?
So Marlene is an evolutionary biologist. So she deals all the time with people saying that certain traits, like personality traits or skills, are things that are just innate, meaning that somehow some people are just born with certain abilities and other abilities are learned as we grow up. It's kind of a nature versus nurture idea. The terms get thrown around a lot in the media. You hear a lot about certain traits being learned versus certain traits being innate. And the fact is that what we know now from evolutionary biology is that it's very, very difficult to separate those two things out. There's a lot of traits, everything from diseases to skill sets that you may be born with a genetic predilection for, but you'd need a specific environment to activate that genetic sequence of events. And so the interaction between our genes and our environment is very complex, and it's something that we still don't entirely understand. But what we do know is that you really can't say that there's any particular skill that is learned versus innate. It's not a realistic distinction. And so it just drives evolutionary biologists nuts when you say things like, this is a hardwired skill, or women are just hardwired to feel a certain way, and you know, men are just hardwired to do something else. Those are all meaningless terms scientifically. There's no hardwired, unless you're talking about things like being hardwired to breathe, in which case, okay, roll with that.
All right, I'm going to say guilty on a couple of counts. How about you? Fess up. Have you been misusing any of these terms, Annalee?
I think the one that I misuse the most is a mathematical term, actually the term statistically significant, which for a really long time, I thought that that just meant that it was something that was significant, you know, and it turns out, actually, as the mathematician I spoke with, Jordan Ellenberg, said, actually, really, it should be more like statistically noticeable or discernible. It just means anything that is more noticeable than zero. So it can be something that's, you know, a tiny fraction of a percentage point away from zero in order to be statistically significant. So that's one thing that I really had to change my thinking about.
There are others on the list: gene, survival of the fittest, quantum weirdness that we are not going to get to. But Annalee, I want to thank you for bringing us through those that are significant, statistically discernible anyway.
Thank you very much for having me.
Annalee Newitz, editor-in-chief at IO9, Gawker Media Science and Culture blog. She's also author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. We were talking about her article, 10 Scientific Ideas Scientists Wish You Would Stop Misusing. You can find a link to read that for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Just when did hardwired or survival of the fittest enter our vocabulary? When Word of Mouth returns, using new terminology to understand cultural history, one year at a time.
In 1977, there was a trend to create oversized accessories for runway models. Runway models would be carrying giant purses, and they would supersize the purses. It's not until the mid-1990s that McDonald's picks up the term.
There's more Word of Mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you had to guess when the phrase text message entered written English, which year would you choose? Maybe 2000, 2004? According to the Oxford English Dictionary and the journal American Speech, the year was 1977, the same year as Microwavable and Brewski, which was written into a script for the new hit show Saturday Night Live. That surprise came to us, not from Wikipedia, the Urban Dictionary, or other sites people turn up for up-to-date information, but from the humble dictionary. Our guest Dave Wilton is author of Word Myths and editor at wordorigins.com. He writes a column for Reminisce magazine about when words burst onto the written scene and joins us on the line to talk about the new words of 1977. Dave, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So how can the dictionary give us insight into the culture, the life of a particular year?
Well, you can look at when words are first cited in the dictionary. You can take a historical dictionary, like the Oxford English Dictionary. That's one that lists usages of the words and how the words change in meaning over time. You can see when new words enter the language, or at least enter the written record of the language, and when new senses, new meanings of words, of existing words, enter the language. So you can kind of track the cultural landscape through the words we use.
So I know you do this for other years, but we read 15 terms that first appeared in print in the year 1977. Text messages was the most surprising to me. What was it describing back then?
Yeah, it had a slightly different meaning when it first came in 1977. It was simply any textual message that was sent over a computer network. So an email might be referred to as a text message. Now, our current sense of something you send over a cell phone or a mobile came about with the advent of SMS text messaging in the 1990s.
77 was the same year that Star Wars was released. So, you know, we were presented with this particular vision of another time, another futuristic or past time. So when searching for words to pick out, I'm wondering how much you look into context. Obviously, you chose 15 particular words that said something about who we were in 77.
Exactly. When I compiled the list, I actually looked up words that tended to resonate. So there were, in 1977, several technical terms, FTP, the initialism for file transfer protocol, appears as a verb, to FTP a file. A new technology was home vid, a shortened form of home video. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a word that didn't survive. We don't use home vid much anymore, but it was something that was very current in 1977 with the advent of the VCR.
Well, also quite appropriate to 1977, the word mellow.
Yeah, well, the 1977 term mellow is, again, it's a change in the sense of the word. And this is the mellow, the noun, to have a mellow, to have a state of relaxation or comfort.
Harsh someone's mellow?
Yeah, to harsh someone's mellow is a good example of its use.
So that went through a change. Supersize as a verb also enters the written scene in 77. Again, not quite how we think of it now. What did it originally refer to?
It comes out to us out of fashion, surprisingly. In 1977, there was a trend to create oversized accessories for runway models. Runway models would be carrying giant purses, and they would supersize the purses. It's not until the mid-1990s that McDonald's picks up the term.
I think of shoulder pads. Was this the beginning of shoulder pads or something?
It very well may be. I'm not sure that the word supersize is associated with shoulder pads in particular, but certainly the right time frame.
Scarves, hats, collars.
Exactly. Collars, yeah.
Well, most of the words that you do feature are still in our lexicon to some degree, like nip and tuck as a term for cosmetic surgery, the wedgie, the ever-enduring wedgie. Tell us about these.
Nip and tuck obviously comes out of plastic surgery, and it's a slang term that kind of enters into the general discourse as cosmetic surgery becomes more and more common. Wedgie is probably a term that's been around for a long, long time, but it makes its way into print in 1977.
Why do you think, Dave, that some of these words continue to make it, whereas there was another word from there, from temp to perm. You know, now we call that person the permalancer, I think.
Well, yeah, because it just changes in fashion. Particularly business jargon will tend to change. Slang and jargon often changes because you want to use the terms that sound in and that pull you into the in-group. And as soon as they start becoming widely used, they lose their cachet. And as soon as your parents or grandparents start using the cool slang term, the kid's not going to use it anymore. So then they come up with new terms, and the old slang term kind of drops out. Same thing can happen with business jargon like temp to perm.
Dave Wilton, contributor to Reminisce magazine. He's also editor at wordorigins.com. Dave, thank you very much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
Well, if 1977 doesn't speak to you, perhaps you'd like to look up a different year in the Oxford English Dictionary. We asked Dave Wilton how the non-linguist among us can do it. And the answer isn't all that surprising. Check your local library. If it does not have access to the OED, a nearby university or college will. We're going to continue our look into the origins of words and phrases with a familiar music term, rock and roll. We know it when we hear it, but what does it mean? Thoughtcast Jenny Atea has the answer.
Okay, so what does the word rock mean? For starters, it's a noun, as in a stone, and it's also a verb, as in to sway back and forth, hence rock and roll.
We gotta rock, we gotta roll.
But where did these meanings come from? Way back when, in the Hebrew Bible, the word rock was actually a stand-in or symbol for God. So too in the New Testament.
Rock of ages, cleft for me.
God the rock. It kind of makes sense. This hymn dates from the late 18th century. Meanwhile, back in the 9th century or thereabouts, another meaning was brewing, this time in the cold north. The Old English came up with the term rockian, which meant to sway, while the Vikings went with rukia, meaning to move, pull, or tear, and the Germans produced rucken, to move jerkily. The mid-18th century witnessed the appearance of the rocking horse and rocking chair, and a rockabye lullaby was first recorded in 1805. So, how do we get from a nursery rhyme to rock and roll?
Most people are familiar with the phrase rock and roll describing a style of music that really came into its own in the mid-1950s. Before that, it was a lyric used in rhythm and blues songs to describe having sex.
Ken Zambello is a professor at the Berklee College of Music here in Boston.
So for a rhythm and blues song to be about sex, since they couldn't say sex, they had to come up with other phrases. So rock and roll became a way of describing that.
Well, why don't you rock me? Rock me all night long.
The phrase rockin' and rolling was a way to kind of get around censorship.
Love me all night long.
Ooh, squeeze me.
Squeeze me all night long.
After rock and roll became more of an accepted phrase of describing the style of music, the sexual connotation kind of ceased a little bit, and it became much more of a generic term that people could use in lots of different songs and have a much more of a wholesome meaning, I guess. You know, good rockin' tonight was more like, you know, dancing.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock.
But dancing is a stand-in for sex, isn't it?
Well, it depends on how you're dancing, I suppose.
Rock, we're gonna rock around the clock tonight. What is that right song?
Well, this song's sure easy to dance to. Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and his Comets was the first rock and roll record to reach the top of the pop charts. So, rock and roll had its heyday. But what's this business with hard rock? Is it a merging of the Rock of God, of Gibraltar, and of Granite with the rolling we engage in on the dance floor? Actually, hard rock is hard because it's hard on the ears. Rumble, by Link Wray dates back to 1958. And finally, rock is also apparently short for rockfish, which is, in other words, a striped bass. That usage dates back to 1690. Oh, and let's not forget Rock Hudson and Stone Phillips. That's it for this week's Word of the Week. I'm Jenny Atia.
Here's a term of the moment for you, gender-responsive design. We'll talk to NHPR's Emily Corwin about the idea that creating a prison specifically for female inmates can help promote more communal and less violent encounters among inmates. That's after the news from NHPR.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The closest many of us will get to a women's prison is watching the Netflix series Orange is the New Black. The series presents the histories and crimes and experiences of fictional female inmates as a world apart from those found in a men's penitentiary. NHPR's Emily Corwin brings us the real story set in New Hampshire, where architects are working with the Department of Corrections to design a $38 million state prison for women. And unlike most women's prisons around the country, this 224-bed prison is being designed for the particular needs of female inmates.
New Hampshire's state prison for men is a pretty typical prison. It's crowded, there's not a lot of natural light, and inmates can't leave their units without permission. The new women's prison will be built right behind the men's prison in Concord. There, things are going to be different.
I have the most recent sketch.
Deputy Commissioner of Corrections Bill McGonigal is overseeing the architect's work.
We're staying away from large dormitories. We went with all two-person cells so that when you go home, you have your roommate, just like, you know, when you went to college, it was that same kind of environment, except the doors sometimes lock.
So why will this prison look more like college? Well, McGonigal has some statistics on his mind, like the fact that nationally, around 90% of women who end up behind bars have histories of sexual and domestic abuse. They also have higher incidence of mental health and addiction problems.
We wanted to make sure that the facility supported the effects of trauma, the significant history of mental illness and substance abuse.
2 decades ago, researchers and activists began demanding that prison staff and programs be more sensitive to these circumstances, or as they call it, more gender responsive. New Hampshire's Corrections Department is committed to that idea and has turned to Arthur Thompson. He's an architect who applies these concepts to prison design.
The offenders who are in this building are all minimum or medium custody level.
12 years ago, Thompson designed a women's prison in Windom, Maine. It's held up now as a national model for gender-responsive design, and that's where we recently met up with him. Here, a few women sit around watching TV in an open lounge area. Thompson points out upholstered couches and wood coffee tables.
The softness of the materials. Natural light is a really important aspect to making this a more normative environment.
What you don't hear is the typical prison cacophony of steel doors echoing against cinder block, sounds that can trigger stress reactions for some trauma survivors and others.
This is my first time coming to prison or jail in my life, and when I walked through the doors, I was like, this doesn't look like a prison. Yeah, I was really shocked.
This is Kara Bouchard. She's a 27-year-old mother of two doing 9 months for theft by deception. You still lose your dignity, says Bouchard. On arrival, she was strip-searched and told to squat and cough. But now that she's settled in, she says the physical environment makes it easier to focus on her anger management, personal healing, and community college classes.
It makes you feel like at home in here. It feels like I'm at college. I don't feel like I'm in prison.
Of course, getting equal access to those kinds of educational opportunities brought about the building of the new women's prison in New Hampshire in the first place. But for inmates with longer sentences, the warm environment at Wyndham may actually be a less important factor. Jody Holmes is 3 years into her 6-year sentence for aggravated assault.
I've been in federal prison before I came here.
Holmes says the environments in federal prison were cold compared to Wyndham, but she preferred it there because each housing unit had a separate building.
People with a longer sentence feel more trapped. And in federal, it was more community and less bickering. You could have like little homes. It wasn't little homes. It was just little buildings, but it was more like a community.
Back in New Hampshire, Deputy Commissioner Bill McGonigal says fostering community is a goal of the gender-responsive approach. It's not clear yet if New Hampshire can afford multiple buildings, but he says he hopes open spaces inside the building will encourage that kind of interaction.
Women want to be more relational and their connections with other women. It's one of their strengths.
The facility in Wyndham was built with this idea in mind. Tables and couches are set up in open areas which all medium and minimum security women have access to. But Jody Holmes and Kara Bouchard say the open spaces do create opportunities for harassment between inmates. Making friends here is not easy.
The first year that I got here, I was ridiculed and put down and treated very badly. Yeah.
I honestly get picked on
all
the time, not going to lie.
Alyssa Benedict consults to prisons on gender-responsive programming. She says you can't just build the space, you have to staff it with enough well-trained officers.
You have to actually train your staff to understand female development, how they relate to each other, and how to, as a staff member, insert yourself in a skillful way to create safety.
Bill McGonigal says staffing at the new prison in Concord is still in question. The Concord Men's Prison next door is chronically understaffed, with officers required to work 2 to 3 16-hour days a week. The department has requested increased women's personnel, but that'll be subject to the next round of budget negotiations at the State House. It's just the building lawmakers have funded so far. McGonigal says his main focus here is on providing women parity with the men when it comes to space for educational programs.
Access to recreation classrooms, both for vocational classrooms, regular education classrooms.
But Alyssa Benedict says opportunities to build relationships and access to safe, quiet environments should not be limited to female inmates. Men need those things, too.
It's almost why we have to tackle the prison paradigm gender aside on some level.
Of course, any changes to the men's prison are unlikely here in New Hampshire. Construction crews break ground for the new women's prison on August 18th. The prison is slated to open October of 2016. For Word of Mouth, I'm Emily Corwin.
And Emily Corwin joins us in the studio with more on that story. Emily, thanks for coming in.
Thanks. Hi.
We heard about gender-responsive design in your piece. Give us a little more on the origins of that idea.
Sure. So about 20 years ago, a few researchers recognized that services in prisons, like treatment programs, were being just sort of copy-pasted from men's prisons into women's prisons without any sort of attention to the different experiences that women inmates have. And in fact, women inmates have, 90% of them have histories of sexual trauma and domestic.
90?
90 domestic abuse. Women also have higher instances of mental health problems. There are a lot of these kinds of ways that women come into the system with different experiences. And so there was this effort to make the programming respond to that, trauma-informed, sort of gender-responsive. This is the lingo that started being used. And it wasn't until, maybe a little bit more recently, like last 10, 15 years, that architects like the ones working on the New Hampshire prison started adopting those ideas and working them into their prison design.
Well, you spoke to the architect who also designed a standalone women's unit at a Maine Correctional Center, which received a lot of recognition for its soft surfaces, for its soft colors. This was 12 years ago. How has that facility weathered?
Yeah, so I did get a tour there. It's there's a lot of natural light. You know, you can see sort of down the hallway. You can see where people are coming from. I can understand how that would be helpful. It feels like college. It feels kind of like maybe a community college. So you're asking how it wears, and so it looks good. I've heard that men, you know, that they may destroy furniture a little faster, that male inmates aren't quite as respectful of their environment. I don't know if that's true or not. But that reminds me of something I wanted to mention, which is that there's this interesting issue that comes up with this whole gender-responsive approach. I was talking to a consultant named Alyssa Benedict, who works in Connecticut with prisons around the region. And she was telling me that it's really too easy for prison administrators to sort of make sweeping generalizations about what gender responsivity means and to conclude that there are these sort of like victimized, traumatized women inmates who need safety and they need privacy and they need natural light and comfy furniture. And the flip of that would be that male inmates, you know, who are stereotyped as these sort of hardened, predatory criminal people, that they should continue to just be sort of managed in a warehouse kind of environment, and that they wouldn't need security or safety or privacy, positive relationships. They need all of those things. We all, women and men, have the same fundamental needs. And the gender responsivity should be about delivering assistance, delivering the treatment, the programs in a way that makes sense considering our different experiences. It should not be about providing different fundamental resources. It shouldn't be about that. It should be about how those things are provided.
So both from your own impression, but also, you know, the data, does design actually make a difference in the outcomes of interaction with prisoners?
I couldn't find any direct data saying recidivism rates go down when you have a prison designed that's gender responsive. I don't know. On the other hand, everybody, including the architects who I talked to, agree that the most important thing is programming, it's staff, it's having enough trained staff to keep an environment safe. You know, the truth is that having enough staff in prisons is a major problem nationally and here.
Well, that was a little shocking to me. I know that the building of prisons, there's often a lot of advocacy for them because they employ so many people. There are so many people looking for work. Why are prisons so chronically understaffed?
Well, I'm just going to talk about New Hampshire because that's what I know about.
Okay.
And New Hampshire's prisons are chronically understaffed. This is a problem that goes back, you know, at least 10 years, probably more. It has mostly to do with the budget. It's hard to convince the public and to convince lawmakers that the prison system is where our money needs to go when there's, you know, so much demand from everywhere else. So in order to keep lower staffing levels, they have people working forced overtime. A lot of officers are working, you know, three double shifts a week.
But that costs a lot of money.
It costs a lot in overtime, but it saves money in benefits. And there's some sort of calculation, like there's X number of months or years for which overtime is actually cheaper than benefits, and then it switches. So right now they've got 60 security staff short pretty much at all times.
Well, what I'm hearing here is, you know, less money for staffing, less money for programming. Our country's mood around corrections tends to go through cycles, you know, a kind of treat people, rehabilitate them, or just incarcerate, you know, sort of lock them up and throw away the key kind of thing. What is the political will here for improving design or programming or staffing for New Hampshire's prisoners?
I think that there's a lot of support for this new women's prison. I think now that that is done, the deed is done, the money is in the budget for a new prison, I think people are excited about it and feel good about it. I don't think that there's a lot of appetite for spending more on, say, operations or the men's prison. I know that there's going to have to be a bigger operations budget for the new women's prison, but I do know that Commissioner Bill Wren is really worried about staffing it adequately, especially right away. So I do think there's sort of like this maybe general shift in public awareness and possibly in political will around, you know, shifting from a really punishment-heavy ideology back towards the sort of treatment-based ideology that was more popular a couple decades ago. And maybe that's what we're seeing in part with this women's prison and all of its sort of emphasis on a normal feeling environment. But I know that, you know, the men's prison does not feel normal. It feels quite punitive, or you know, like a warehouse. And I don't think that there's really any expectation that that'll change anytime soon.
NHPR's Emily Corwin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.
Emily is working on more stories about New Hampshire's prison system, but you can hear what she's produced so far. There are links at wordofmouthradio.org. We just heard about the high incidence of mental illness among the female prison population, but mental illness does not discriminate by gender or race or socioeconomic status or celebrity. And still, its stigma is almost impossible to shake, even for a talented NBA athlete. Why Delonte West became a basketball pariah, when Word of Mouth continues after a short break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 2004, Delonte West was drafted by the Boston Celtics. Known for a strong work ethic and fervent competitiveness, he quickly made a name for himself in the NBA. After a few years with the Celtics, West was traded to the Cleveland Cavaliers and joined the starting lineup alongside a rising star named LeBron James. While West's work on the court was stellar, his mental health was suffering. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and his life quickly began to unravel. A run-in with the law, a salacious rumor, and a Twitter rant later, West became an NBA outcast. Delonte West's story raises questions about the NBA's handling of mental health issues and the stigma of mental health in pro sports in general. Here to discuss both is David Haglund, senior editor at Slate. He runs Browbeat, that's Slate's culture blog, and he wrote an article called Why Isn't Delonte West in the NBA? David, so glad you could join us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, can you take us through the events that led up to Delonte West being cast aside, let's say, by the NBA?
Sure. Well, he was diagnosed with a mood disorder, I believe, in 2008, and then had another excellent season with the Cavaliers. But the summer after that season, he was arrested on the highway near his home in Maryland. He was riding a motorcycle, and he had several guns with him. And his trial on weapons charges was postponed until after the season. So for the rest of the season, he did not talk to the media, had been advised by his lawyer not to speak about what had happened. He assured people it was not as big a deal as it seemed. I mean, there was a shotgun, there was a Magnum 357. It looked very troubling. The Cavaliers were great that year. They went into the playoffs as favorites and then lost. And people wondered why, and then a rumor got started that there had been a relationship between Delonte and LeBron James's mother. This rumor is totally untrue, completely unsubstantiated, but it was cemented in people's minds in part because of this image connected with the diagnosis and also with the arrest that Delonte West was crazy. And when I talked to him, he actually now thinks that the diagnosis was mistaken, that he was suffering from a temporary bout of depression and not exhibiting, you know, symptoms of a chronic disorder. And he's frustrated now by the way in which that label attached itself to him and was used as an explanation for basically everything that he was going through.
Mood disorder and bipolar disorder, there's a big gulf between those two. Did the media play any kind of role in exacerbating this story or his disorder?
I think they did. And really, Delonte's story highlights the shortcomings that the press, and I say this as a member of the press, has exhibited when it comes to covering mental health. You know, some writers were really trying to be sensitive to what he was going through, but they didn't necessarily know a great deal about bipolar disorder or mood disorders more generally. And so it was often brought up as a kind of shorthand explanation. You know, he's having a hard time. Well, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I don't necessarily blame the writers who did that. There are others who ran much more wild with it, and certainly once the rumor got started, speculated, well, maybe it's true. He seems, quote-unquote, crazy enough to do this. And so, you know, it kind of runs the gamut from people who are just insensitive and not really trying to understand to even those who were making a sincere effort but struggling with what is, in fact, an extremely complicated subject.
So did he address the rumors at all, or, you know, the reason why he was carrying several guns on an evening motorcycle ride?
So to hear Delonte tell it, he had these weapons stored in his home and there were kids staying over. And one of them got into the closet where these guns were. And his mother, who was looking after the kids while Delonte slept, woke him up and said, "You have to do something about these weapons." So he got on his motorcycle and was taking them to another residence. And this is the explanation he offered to the state of Maryland when he was tried. And they seemed to believe it. They reached a plea agreement, and he was ultimately only convicted of two misdemeanors and got a house arrest and was sentenced to counseling and community service. So I take him at his word. And, you know, in some ways that incident was blown out of proportion. You know, certainly he feels responsible for it. He feels like it was a bad decision. And, you know, he accepts the punishment that was handed out to him. But he also feels like what happened has been, you know, mischaracterized and was wrapped up in this notion that he was a crazy man who was out on the highway on a motorcycle with guns going after somebody, which he says was not the case.
David Hagland is with us. He's senior editor at Slate. He runs Browbeat, which is Slate's culture blog, and wrote an article about Delonte West and the treatment of mental illness in general within the NBA. So let's be clear. West made some bad decisions, but what your article points to, David, is that there's been a lack of sensitivity or treatment of mental illness issues by the NBA. You present this kid in his 20s coming from a broken family in the projects, thrown into this multi-billion dollar business and expected to deal with it. What was the sense you got from West about how he coped?
Well, he coped in a lot of ways. He had his brother with him when he first started out. Then eventually after the diagnosis, he did speak to psychologists and psychiatrists. But what I think his case helps to illustrate is that the job of an NBA player is incredibly stressful. There's travel and obviously all of the pressure that comes with performing in front of thousands of people multiple times a week. And, you know, the truth is that a lot of players don't get the help that they need. There is this idea within the sports world that it's all about being mentally tough. And some players are reluctant to ask for the kind of help that they may need. Delonte, I should say, did get some of that help. I think that the stigma attached to him after he asked for it, I think he was actually in some ways unusual in that he was willing not only to get the help, but then to speak publicly about it. But in a way that came back to bite him.
Isn't there something to the idea that aggression, the kind of energy, the kind of instability that may fuel a mental illness could also fuel great competition and great athletic prowess on the court?
Yeah, this is one of the most interesting things to me that I came across while working on this piece is this idea that I heard from multiple people that a lot of tendencies and traits that may be unhealthy in other aspects of your life can actually fuel success in sports. So certainly aggression is one of those things that's fairly obvious, but also anxiety even, and obsessiveness in particular, the way that athletes can focus so specifically on the task of, you know, shooting jump shots or whatever it may be. Delonte would spend hours and hours on the court practicing, and he told me that was fueled in part by his insecurities and by beating himself up over and over and telling himself he had to do better next time in a way that he later came to regard as unhealthy, but which really made him a professional basketball player.
So now he's playing professionally in China. What's the future looking like for him? Will we see him back in the NBA?
I think there's a chance he'll make it back. You know, like I said, the people who have played with him, who've coached him, they generally really like him. And one of those people is Doc Rivers, who's now coaching the Los Angeles Clippers after several years in Boston where he coached West. And there's a report that Delonte may play with the Clippers summer league team, which is sort of like a summer tryout. And that may be the first step back into the league. I certainly hope so.
David Hagland, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Hagland, senior editor at Slate. He runs the Browbeat culture blog, and you can find a link to read his article, "Why Isn't Delonte West in the NBA?" That link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for giving Word of Mouth some play today. There's much more to hear and to pass around and to listen to at wordofmouthradio.org. Here's a little preview of something that we're working on for tomorrow. We'll be speaking to a mathematician who's come up with a formula to determine the summer's most unread book. You know, that sort of buzzed about book that you buy in June and think you're going to read all summer, but you just cannot get through. So here's your chance to come out of the closet and proudly declare your unread book, either of all time or whatever is recent. Moby Dick comes to mind, and that's one of the answers that we got in our informal poll around the station, along with a heartbreaking work of staggering genius, The French Lieutenant's Woman, and of course, Stephen Hawking's A Brief History of Time. We'll hear more on that tomorrow. But for right now, share your unread book on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And you can use the hashtag unreadbooks. If you'd like, you can consider it a sort of support group where you share your unattained literary aspirations. Things feel much better when you share them via word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please come back for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.